Should have your Bibles open to Romans chapter 12, verse 16, and we are in the middle section of it, or the middle sentence or statement that deals with the godly conduct and behavior once the thinking of this final sixth component of our wisdom is there, of being of the same mind one toward another. It's going to seek its natural outlet, and that outlet is going to translate into some conduct and behavior in which you're going to neither pay great heed nor attention or special attention as far as cliquish type behavior toward those of high estate matters or differences, mind not high things, but now rather the conjunction there, but begins the second phrase, but condescend to men of low estate. And this is certainly where the bulk of the kind of conduct and behavior a son has is going to be dealt with and comprise the bulk of his conduct and behavior as far as being of the same mind one toward another. So you have, but condescend to men of low estate. Here we have this word condescend. This is the only time, I'm not saying it's the only time the Greek word is ever used, but that's the only time the word condescend ever occurs anywhere in your Bible. So when you talk about condescend, I know some of you probably have done a little bit of work on this. What does it mean? What does it mean to condescend? This is a fascinating word, huh? To come down to a lower level, good. That's good. That's right on the mark. Relinquishment of distinction. Yeah. That's good too. What? Submit yourself, okay. Anybody else? Just giving you that's done some searching on it or thinking on it to give a little time for you to tell me what you've heard. Those are all good. I always start with somebody like Webster in his 1828. Condescend means to descend from the privileges of superior rank or dignity, to do some act to an inferior, which strict justice or the ordinary rules of civility do not require. I kind of like that. I like what Webster does, because in Webster's 1828, by the way, just don't think you can go out on, you know, to Barnes & Noble and grab a Webster's off the shelf there that you're going to find this, because it's all been stripped out of it. But the Webster 1828, almost all of his definitions have Bible verses to identify and help define them. And as he says here, It says, to do some act to an inferior which strict justice or the ordinary rules of civility do not require. Hence to submit or yield, Cindy said that, as to an inferior, implying an occasional relinquishment of distinction, what Katie was talking about. And then he quotes Romans 12:16. I didn't put a lot of this on the board, by the way, because I just figured you've got your own dictionaries. But condescension or condescending is a term that can be used. Have you ever heard this word used in a good sense? It's used in a good sense here. Condescend to men of low estate. But how many of you ever heard it used in a bad sense? Probably more often than not. And that's a shame. That's, again, showing you the narrowing down of a word in our English language because of the degeneration of our language over time. Condescending certainly is a word that can be used in both a good sense and a bad sense, even when somebody doesn't even know exactly what it means. I've heard people in arguments say, "Don't be condescending to me." And they weren't. They were arguing, you know, but maybe sometimes somebody really was. And If you were pressed for the moment to express what does that mean in a bad sense, if somebody, if you say, "Don't be condescending to me," what did they just do? They belittled you. I love that expression too. They belittled. They littled you. They put you into a position of being an inferior. They put you into a low estate position when you think yourself of a higher estate. Don't put me in a lower estate. Don't be condescending to me. Don't belittle me. I didn't have that one, but that's a good word. I like that word, belittle. Yeah.
Is there a connection to not thinking yourself more highly than you ought to think?
Yeah, sure. Because This comes on with all of those components built onto it. Yeah, you've already gotten that high thinking of yours out of the way. Now you're going to be confronted with an area that wasn't covered in that first component, though, that you have a natural attractiveness to, and that is to mind high things and to not condescend to men of low estate. But now with all of that godly thinking, living, and labor from those five components existing, you can now live this way with this final component of godly thinking. And so I, of course, love Charles George Crabb and Charles Smith. Those two guys are two guys of my study books that I work with all the time when I'm working with English words. I like what Charles Smith said about condescending. He said, "Condescending is a term which denotes no more than such a stooping to the condition of inferiors as is compatible with either humility." By the way, that's the good sense of the word. That's the good sense. It denotes a stooping to the condition of inferiors as is compatible with humility. That's the good sense of the word. Or pride. And that's the bad sense of the word. There is a moral and practical condescension which is in the highest degree virtuous and graceful. I love how he describes that. When he's talking about this kind, not specifically this kind, but the good kind of condescending to someone, he says, there is a moral and practical condescension which is in the highest degree virtuous and graceful, as when the strong condescend to the weak, the wise to the ignorant, the bold to the timid, the upright and self-controlled to the defects and infirmities of others. That's the good kind. And there is a formal and ceremonious condescension which is compatible with a great amount of pride, carrying with it an assumption of the elevated or meritorious, and is, in short, an arrogant politeness. Now, condescending to men of low estate, don't confuse this with pity. This is not the issue of pity, as if one in a low estate needs for you to show him pity. No, he needs to be condescended to by one who is in a higher state than him. In order to be able to deal with him, you have to deal with his estate difference, and it may be one lower than yours. The Oxford English Dictionary, when describing condescending or condescend, says, and I've cut a lot of things out, I've tried to shortcut a lot of this, it says it means to come down voluntarily. I like that. Come down voluntarily. To depart from the privileges of superiority by a voluntary submission. To sink willingly to equal terms with inferiors. And then it quotes, it says, Bible, Romans 12, verse 16. Charles Crabb, one of my favorite synonym authors, says, "Condescension marks the act of condescending from one's own height to yield to the satisfaction of others." You have them in mind. "Rather than rigorously to exact one's rights." Yeah, as a son, you don't have to do that. But if you're going to function as a body, you're going to have to condescend to men of low estate. George Crabb goes on to say, "The infirmities, the wants, the defects and foibles of others call for condescension. A wise son, therefore, a son's wise condescending to men of low estate is to make sure, to ensure, that none of those lower estate differences ever gives an inkling to that lower estate saint that there is problems between you and him. That's what that is designed. Condescending to that lower estate saint, when you condescend to men of low estate, it should never give an inkling to that saint that a problem between you and him exists, or that there's a hindrance, or that there's an obstacle or a wall where we can't fellowship with one another or anything like that because of those low estate differences. And by condescending to men of low estate, you're ensuring that that saint never feels, never thinks as if they are no longer important to that body, or not as welcome, or not as useful to the body. It's to eliminate that kind of thinking. Now, a saint of low estate, you're not trying to make them, you're not trying to put on airs. You're not trying to make them think they're something they're not. You're condescending to them so that they recognize the estate they're in, especially when you're talking about an edificational estate difference, where they're way behind spiritually or way behind doctrinally or edification-wise. They still gain tremendous encouragement to stay with it when you condescend to them in their edificational estate lowness, because it encourages them that you were there yourself, that they realize they're just as much of an important part of the body as you yourself are. And so we as sons are to adopt, no pun intended there, but we are to adopt a course of action of not allowing estate differences to present any problems with our fellowshipping with that person. This may be a good measure of the degree in which you have your father's wisdom. Are you able to do that? Would you be able to do that? Where estate difference, whatever the estate difference is, we adopt a course of action that is not going to present any problem to our fellowshipping with that person, any hindrance to proper function of the body of the assembly. Now, when a saint knows that his low estate differences are well known to the assembly, and when a course of action is taken by others in that assembly that withdraws their fellowship from them, when they are treated differently in light of their low estate, that's not only harsh treatment, but folks, that is a very serious condition of the assembly. You have some serious problems as an assembly. Because when that happens, the fully functioning operations of God in that local assembly cease to function. Division has occurred. Again, when you're going to have to take some of what I'm saying here, and you're going to have to, as an adult son, you're going to have to think up about, and you should spend some time, maybe this afternoon when you're sitting on your porch or something, rolling this over in your mind of the kind of scenarios we could face here, or that you either have faced or you might face in this assembly. You're not given a bunch of examples here. This isn't a case book. You're not given case after case after case after case of the kind of way you're to conduct yourself, the kind of ways in which you're to behave yourself. You're supposed to, as a son, adult son, figure that out on your own. And you can figure that out on your own. But you're guided exactly by what it says, by exactly what it says. Condescend to men of low estate. And that's what should be happening. Now, we've talked a lot about the estate differences and everything. But again, if that doesn't take place, and you're not able to conduct yourself both properly by not minding those of a high estate difference, mind not high things, and can easily condescend to men of low estate, you can bend down to their level and be able to deal with them on their level, not try to ignore or pretend that the estate differences don't exist, but you're going to allow them to exist, and you're going to determine that they do not become a factor or a problem in your dealings with that person. So any questions about the godly conduct and behavior aspect of it? That's really about all I want to say about that, because we've said an awful lot about this in our introduction. But that's the kind of conduct, and again, the kinds of it, I'm leaving to you, that you're going to have to think up and either think up or be aware of when you think about the kind of interaction you're having. By the way, you begin to see God actually is teaching us, just as a body, we're supposed to be connected. They're supposed to be fellowship. Fellowship, as I said, I think the last is, I don't know, I it seems to me like when I first introduced the issue of sonship, that was just a class or two ago. But I think in the last class, the last class, next to the last class, I said something about to the effect that the word fellowship is going to take on meanings that you never even thought of before. And it will. And I mean in terms of what it means to be a fellow member of a body and to have fellowship with them as members of that body. Well, I'm going to kind of push through this so that we can try to wrap this up today, and if we need loose ends tied together, we'll do it on Wednesday. But with that, with the godly thinking being of the same, be of the same mind one toward another, and with the natural outlet for the godly thinking to be the godly conduct and behavior of mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate, that then has a natural outlet for you. This is kind of the one we're scratching our heads about. How is this labor? But this has a natural outlet for you and provides for you to labor together with your Father, with those saints in the local assembly to the full extent to which God has designed every saint in the assembly to function mutually together. Just like He designed your body. Your body is one of the most marvelously designed entities in all of creation in how it is designed to mutually function together. It's amazing. I used to talk about how that they used to use these great big Cray computers, and they tried to come up with just the computer program for taking one step, for a human body to take one step, and how many things the body does in doing that, how it takes your center of gravity, moves it forward to where you're almost out of balance, but then certain other counteractions take place, like the moving of your arms to give you balance and symmetry to be able to take that step, where load bearing comes into play, where all of these joints and all of these different things all occur, and they all occur mutually together. It's just, and we're just talking about one step, and it took reams and reams of paper just to give a computer printout of what it would take for one step to occur in a human body if a computer was to program it. And so, and if there's that kind of symmetry and mutual workmanship that has gone into the human body, and you are supposed to think of a local assembly in terms of body type thinking, then folks, the way He's designed a local assembly to function, the way He's designed the creature to function, is one of the most marvelously put together things of mutual working parts that ever has existed from the hand of God. And so this is an exciting thing to be able to labor with God, with the saints in the assembly, to the full extent that He's designed every saint in the assembly to function mutually together, one with another, without any hindrances occurring whatsoever, with the full cooperative effort of the saints in it. And that's to be done by you being not wise in your own conceits. Be not wise in your own conceits is the godly labor. Well, there's a word here that's going to take a little work. That word conceit, it's in the plural here, conceits. Conceit. We've heard it, we've used it, it's a familiar word, certainly hasn't fallen out of use. But what is conceit? What does conceit mean?
Self-centeredness.
Good. Anybody else? Yeah, that's a word you oftentimes, well, that person is conceited. Yeah, self-centeredness. I always use a little more slangish expression, they're full of themselves. Anybody else?
Arrogant pride.
Yeah, you can't hardly talk about conceit without talking about arrogance and pride, and that's right on the mark, because conceit is wrapped up in pride and arrogance.
Self-flattering opinion.
Yeah, that's good. Narcissistic. Yep. I'd expect that from a scientist. Good term. Yeah, we'll come back to that. Because there's a far more serious word that we can apply that you'll see than silly, but you're on the right track, and that's good. Self-humoring. Yeah. I like the way we're moving too, because we're moving in the right direction. But what was one of the terms that I came back and actually talked about this in connection with a creature? Vanity. Yeah. All right. Good. That's great. Let me give you what I've got. From Webster's 1828, he says, that which is conceived, first of all, conceit. It's very akin to that English word that we have, conceive. When you conceive of something, what have you done? You imagined it. You created it in your mind. And that's what conceit is. First and foremost, and most basically, it's something conceived or imagined or formed in the mind. It's an idea, a thought, an imagination, an opinion, a notion, a fancy, just to throw out some expressions. The OED says that which is conceived in the mind, conceit is conceived in the mind, a conception, notion, idea, thought, a device, a personal opinion, judgment or estimation that has been colored, I love this one, by overestimation of one's own qualities. This goes right to the pride and vanity issue. A personal opinion, judgment, or estimation that has been colored by overestimation of one's own qualities, personal vanity or pride. Going back to my buddy George Crabb, he says that conceit is a term conceit is a term that expresses the working of the imagination in its distorted state. Conceit is the most severe expression of vanity. And that's when we get that idea of vanity. I know my mom, I never could figure that one out, this one out. My mom and dad had the old, I don't know when it was made, but probably 1950s or early 50s, the what they call, Luke would know, but would appreciate, waterfall kind of bedroom suit. And she had everything matched, and she had this big vanity. And it had this enormous round mirror. It was a circular mirror, big thing. And you'd sit at it, and it had that waterfall design in the drawers and everything. I used to spend a lot of time there because the biggest drawer on the left had all the family pictures in it. And I loved going through the old family pictures. But why is that called a vanity? Well, it's because a woman sits there and she primps and she puts on stuff and she combs and she rouges and she does all those other things that she does. But that idea is one in which you, of course, are looking at yourself and you're putting yourself in the best light possible and all of that kind of thing. And whether you're ugly or not, you're imagining yourself to be pretty. Well, condescension coming from that is really one of the more serious, intensified, and more severe expressions of vanity. And so you would have vanity, but then if you want to talk about vanity in its worsened state, you come and talk about it as being conceit. And that's really the state that those entities that are now in the creature, in the intelligentsia of the creature, are in. But what I like that George Crabb said, he says, what we conceit, he uses it that way. I've never heard it used that way. That was great. What we conceit, he says, is preposterous. It's a species of invention. The word invention. Conceit is a species of the word invention. And by the way, God doesn't think too highly of inventions. I'm not talking about inventions like the wheel and things like that. I'm talking about inventions like what is invented in the mind. He says this in Psalm 99:8. He says, "Thou answerest them." He's talking about Israel and their worthiness to be under the wrath of God. He says, "Thou answerest them, O Lord our God. Thou wast a God that forgavest them, though thou tookest vengeance upon their inventions." Came from their conceit. 106 Psalm in two places says, thus they provoked him to anger with their inventions, and the plague break in upon them. Thus they were defiled with their own works and went a-whoring with their own inventions. Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 12 says, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge of witty inventions. Now, we were talking about, what was it you said, silly notions. Well, let's push silly to its furthest degree, and we're starting to get where conceit is. If something is silly or foolish and you take it to and just push it to its nth degree, what is the person? They're a fool. I've said fool, though. Move it, just get it to its most nastiest degree possible. Stupid? That doesn't even describe it. Insane. They're in the funny farm. They need to be in a rubber room. That's exactly where conceit is going. Conceit is nearly, it's not quite there, but it's nearly akin to insanity. I like what George Crabbe said. He said, some conceit themselves to be kings and queens, though they're not. Some conceit themselves very learned while they know nothing, or very wise and clever while they are exposing themselves to perpetual ridicule for their folly, or very handsome while the world calls them plain, or very peaceable while they're always quarreling with their neighbors, or very humble while they are tenaciously sticking for their own. Conceit is a term of near insanity. You could almost be called, yeah, that guy's crazy. He thinks, we had a guy in our little bitty town in Jefferson, Indiana, about 250, 300 people. We had a guy in our town that actually thought he was the mayor of the town. We had no vote. We had no council. We had nothing. But he fancied himself to be the mayor. He was a little goofy. Little nuts. All right? That's conceit. But be very careful. Conceit is a very offensive and highly disgusting and serious matter to God. This is one of the most serious matters to your Father. This is one of the reasons He ends this particular portion of your fundamental wisdom with, be not wise in your own conceits. And conceit being the last word that He has to say to you on the matter of His godly wisdom. Because of how serious of a matter it is to Him. He says in Proverbs 28:11, the rich man is wise in his own conceit, but the poor that hath understanding searcheth him out. In Proverbs 26:16, he says, the sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. And here's my personal favorite of them all, and I want you to see this one. Proverbs 26:12. Seest thou a man wise in his own conceit? There is more hope of a fool than of him. You see, he's beyond the fool. He's entered the world of insanity. He's a legend in his own mind. And I have in my notes here, read again from Crabbe's page 100, and I forgot to bring the book. But there is some marvelous things that George Crabbe goes into. It's good that I didn't bring it so that we can just get on with it. But there really are some fantastic truisms that he goes into. But what you would be doing is you would be continually going into the issue of what the word conceit means, which is okay. It's not out of line for this aspect of be not wise in your own conceit. But it's not going to fully make us understand just how is this godly labor? And how is it the natural outlet for some labor that comes from being of the same mind one toward another and then minding not high things but condescending to men of low estate? Well, with all of that said about conceit, and I kind of wish I did have that from George Crabbe, but Like I said, it's probably good I don't. So I think we can get out of here on time. Let's make sure before we end this that we're not just taking a dictionary type definition understanding and forcing it into the Word of God. Because we see on the pages of God's Word there, be not wise in your own conceits. Don't be a fool. Don't be insane. Don't try to think of yourself more highly than you should. Well, we've already had that. Don't think that you are something that you're not, so forth and so on. Let's make sure that, because that misses, if my understanding is correct, that misses the labor. That's really not what this is after. But it's not wrong to have all that. You need to know that. So let's get more of a working understanding of it in light of the context in which this is sitting. Now, sure enough, being conceited, and you don't want to be wise in that. You don't want your wisdom and your thinking and your the way in which when you're going to wisely go about doing something and taking information and putting it to its useful purpose to get the proper result and end of it, you're not going to do that by your own conceits. And so the word is used here, and we have to acknowledge that sure enough, the issue of pride and vanity of your own mind, being that legend in your own mind, we acknowledge that. I certainly see that sure enough is there. And being conceited is one who you're just full of yourself, and what you think you bring to the relationship and what you think you bring to the assembly is just the greatest thing since sliced bread. I do love, going back, that bothers me. I go back to Crabb once again. One of the great things that he brought out there was the fact that a conceited person, for instance, he brought up the issue of learning. That a conceited person will try to attempt to gain the quick route of information that it's taken someone else years and years to learn. And they're always trying to gain either information or power or prestige or standing, and they always want to shortcut it and do it their own way, which is always shorter, easier, faster. The greatest criticism I think that I have, now I may be conceited here, but the greatest criticism that I think I have among all of those who listen to me over the internet, and probably among those who sit in this assembly, is that I go way too slow. I'm going to die before I ever get to Romans 16. Let alone get to 2 Thessalonians. That may be a proper criticism, and someone else may be able to do it, but I don't know as if I could have done it any faster to get it effectually working. And my father's got a methodology for that. But let's once again rein this issue of conceit in. If you're full of yourself and thinking that you bring something great to the assembly that no one else has or whatever, that's part of this. But in this context, being wise, and your father's telling you now, son, when you have all of this, you're going to work together with me. And one of honestly, folks, this ought to become your sonship motto as you labor with your father in wise sonship decision-making skill. That your father says, son, when you labor with me, don't you be wise in your own conceits. In this context, being wise in your own conceits, being that it's the very last thing that your father tells you in this whole instruction of wisdom, my understanding is that is talking about you as a son, not to be wise in your own mind. Don't be wise in your own thinking. Granted, I think it applies directly to what's going on here in this component, but I also think it is the way that our father wisely wraps up the entirety of this form of doctrine. Son, you and I are going to do a lot of work together. Just in wisdom alone. We haven't even begun justice, judgment, and equity yet. But just in wisdom alone, we've got a lot of work to do. And when it comes to doing this work wisely, and you're going to work with me, don't be wise in your own thinking, in your own mind, in your own conceits. Don't be wise in your own imagination. In other words, you are never to think that you've been the one to come up with all this wisdom. It's not your wisdom. It's your Father's. You're not, let's use conceive's sister word. You as a son are never ever to think that you've been the one to conceive the wisdom. You didn't conceive it. Your Father did. You're never to think that this body of information you've just received from your Father is somehow your own wisdom. It's not your, and to think that it's not, you're going to operate it on, in, you're going to be wise in your own conceits. Now, true enough, part of the context is that you're not to think that you have some natural specialness or natural special usefulness that you're bringing to the assembly or some special ability or some special assignment. I'm not to think that, even though I'm the pastor, I'm the bishop of the assembly. I recognize the fact that your assignment, I already recognize from verse 3 that you've been dealt the same measure of faith I've been dealt with. Some of you are meeting practical needs in this assembly and are fulfilling offices for practical needs. Those are just as critical as me and the deacons fulfilling the edificational needs of the local assembly. We don't exist without either one. So, by the way, that's a big departure from how I used to teach years ago. But body thinking and sonship has changed all that. So you true enough recognize that you're not somebody who is on special assignment because you have a higher estate than somebody else. And I'm saying that all of that's part of this, of being not wise in your own conceit. That's true enough. That context, it certainly demands that you understand you're not to think that way. You're not to have that kind of thinking. But as this is a very peculiar and unique, it's a unique ending. It's not just the ending of a component to a form of doctrine, it's the ending to the entire form of doctrine. And as it ends the instruction of wisdom, and the very last word of it is that word conceits, the godly labor is, all right, now you have this fundamental package. You have this whole body of information of godly wisdom that allows for you to make wise sonship decisions in every area of your life. We went 360 degrees around. It's encompassed you, starting with godly selfless love, then loving kindness, and then working with that loving kindness in your job environment, and having to incur some trouble, some tribulations that come your way in the common circumstances of your living in the world at large and operating upon that hope doctrine, and then wisely dealing with saints and lost people with the feature of godly tender-heartedness, and how you're going to deal with both of those groups of people with that tender-heartedness, to finally dealing with these estate differences. Son, you now have this whole packet of wisdom. And my understanding is, For the final labor issue here, when Paul says, be not wise in your own conceits, as the godly labor of this final component, my understanding is that the operations of God in the local assembly can now be carried out by the local assembly. Where wisdom is concerned, all the wise operations can be carried out. You've received all this wisdom. We've even dealt with the estate issues that can trip up an assembly and get divisions created. So the labor comes along and says, your Father says, son, you've got all this packet of information. And what this is telling you through the Apostle Paul is, Now go out and labor with our father. Go labor with your father. But when you do it without an ounce of conceit involved. That's your labor. Your labor now is to not only take this component of doctrine, be able to wisely deal with other saints who are in the difficult circumstances of being in either a high estate or low estate than you, but as the end of the whole form of doctrine, it comes along and says, our Father says to us, I want you to labor with me now. Let's go out and do this. We've been sitting in the classroom. Now let's go do it. Let's wisely begin to labor together. But son, when you're going to labor with me, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it without one speck or 1 ounce of conceit involved. It'll kill it. And by conceit, son, you're not going to labor with me with 1 ounce of your own wisdom. You're going to labor with me with my wisdom, with none of your own, but with mine. And here's the kicker, because conceit deals with what we imagine. You're going to labor with me in all of these matters, and don't you dare do what you imagine should be done. Don't you dare do that. Don't you operate on what you imagine should happen. Your imagination is going to be one of the worst enemies you have. Well, I always imagined it this way. Well, I imagined that. I couldn't possibly imagine. That's the problem. And a son doesn't let his imagination ever get to control his thinking, his conduct, or his labor with his father. And this is a tough one. And you probably need to hear this more than just this Bible class. Because I know from personal experience how tough that is to have to operate and almost fly by an entirely different set of instruments than you're used to. But the issue is, you're going to labor with your father now, but you're going to do it with none of what you imagine should be done, not ever thinking for one instant that any of the thinking you're operating on is your thinking. None of the wisdom is your wisdom. It's his wisdom. And these are matters that take up such issues even I've talked to you about and we've discussed together quite often about when it comes to even the issue of dealing with that lost person about the gospel. When you're giving the gospel to someone, and you imagine they should hear John 3:16, or you imagine they should hear Ephesians 2:8 and 9, or you imagine they should hear this, or you imagine they should hear that, and yet you've been trained as an ambassador, and that part of that training is you don't go by what you imagine they should hear, but you know God has designed that inner man to be wanting to receive some particular information that's sitting especially in Romans 3. That's where you want them to hear. You may read Romans 3 there, verses 20 and following, and you think, well, that sounds awful wordy. Or you may think, well, that just sounds too complicated. Or that sounds that doesn't matter. What matters is God designed that human spirit to receive that information, and it's that information that they need to hear. It's not what you imagine they need to hear. Well, we've talked about that. Now, coming to the end of a component, or rather the end of a form of doctrine, our Father puts a premium, be not wise in your own conceits. Like I said, that ought to be put on a flag. That ought to be the motto on our colors for a son. Because as a son, not just as an average old grace believer, but as a son, you've got to walk by faith and not by sight. You're not in Israel's program. The reason we're here, the reason we're going through all of this, the reason I'm not teaching, getting through Romans in 6 lessons and then getting through all of Paul's epistles in a month, the reason we're doing that is because we truly believe what God says, that we're being trained in this assembly and in this life. Well, that sounds ridiculous and it sounds insane to the world. Why, they've got the Hubble telescope. They can tell us everything. Can't science tell us everything that's out there? At least tell us enough to where we're comfortable with that's pretty much everything that's out there. There's planets and gases and elements and stars and this and that and all these things going on, and not one scientist nor one science book you'll ever pick up will even talk about principalities, powers, mights, and dominions. That there's places out there called Persia and Grecia. There's actually 12 segments of it that surround this earth. These are things that you can't see with Hubble. So this is a premium to be not wise in your own conceits. None of your imagination is going to be involved. You're going to go strictly by what your father has taught you. And that's going to occupy the fabric of your thinking. And what your father has taught you as far as where that thinking is to conduct itself and behave itself, and the operations that our father wants to fulfill as we labor together with him in what he's doing. And now for the first time in your life, you have the ability to not be wise in your own conceits. Do you realize you couldn't be told that before this point? Because until you got your first form of doctrine in the sonship curriculum, all you had was your own conceits. And do you realize that is pretty much the Christian way of life in this country today? Because the average Christian operates on some pieces of the Bible, but pretty much their Christian life is all their own imagination. Cindy and I going to church today, about 5-6 cars ahead of us hit a deer. It wasn't Bambi. The way that deer flew, it was Rudolph. And you could say, had I not retied my tie, we would have maybe hit that car. God moved me to retie my tie. I'm being wise in my own conceits. I'm imagining the Christian way of life instead of putting blinders onto that and going by the book and only the book. And really, for the first time in our life, we can do this now. Be not wise in our own conceits. So your godly labor here is to use what your father just taught you and what has been now written, and hopefully when we get together on Wednesday night, written on the fleshy tables of your heart, and never ever now, son, inject into all your wisdom one bit of your imagination, one bit of your wisdom, one bit of your preferences. Well, I'd prefer the high estate. We're not interested in what you would prefer. So there's quite a bit to all of this. And the godly labor, though, is to now just simply go out and function with this wisdom without any conceit. It's just that simple. Well, that really takes us to the end of everything quite nicely. So we have the whole first form of doctrine. Gosh, we can go back to this chart. Put all those verses back up there. And now you've got it. Well, we're out of time on Wednesday night. Unless there's any pressing questions at all. Nobody's got their hand up going, whoa. We can entertain some of that. What I want to do now is, on Wednesday, we need to once again make sure that we are getting that post-doctrinal exhortation for the last time, going back to Proverbs 3. And then we can entertain any questions, any answers, or any comments next Sunday before we begin the next body of instruction, before we begin verse 17 and begin our instruction of justice. I would like to have the Lord's table, wouldn't you? And so we'll probably, I'll get with Cecil as soon as I can. If I can just get him pinned down, he's He's got all that energy and he's running around everywhere. If he would just get a little older to where he'd calm down. We need to get the board together and make sure that we're squared away. But let's have a good communion service, because we can bring all this to the table now. The last time we had it was at the end of verse 8, when we just had the first component. Because that positive proper response underscored something about the new covenant. And so now with the whole form of doctrine, to be able to make wise sonship decisions, fundamentally, we can bring this to the table and be thinking about how meaningful it is to the impact that we're having in the heavenly places and those kinds of things. And we can speak of that when we get together for the Lord's table. And you'll all have an equal opportunity, as I do, to be able to talk about it, as we experienced last time when we kind of broke the ice on how we're moving toward more of a family body style communion service and observance of the Lord's table, much like Paul talked to the Corinthians about when you come together and that kind of thing. So let's go ahead and do that, and we'll plan that for next Sunday. And I don't know, maybe Wednesday we can have a party or something, because we've reached a milestone. We've got one-fourth of our godly sonship decision-making skills under our belt, and it's something to celebrate. So we'll just see how Wednesday goes, but it'll basically be some question-answer and some comments and going over the post-doctrinal exhortation. I do want to come up with a chart. I want to add this sixth component to the five that I had before, the one that you got, Lisa. And so, and then if you want those, maybe I'll make those off to where you can have those in line, so they can be a real quick reminder, of course, of the thinking, the living, and the labor where all of them are involved. So we'll try and do that as well. All right, well, we'll stop right there, and we'll pick this up then when we meet again on Wednesday night.